Hello and welcome to Untangled Resolution's presentation of Sangoma, Stories from the Frontlines of Mediation. I am your host, Batabi Levintombini, mediator and conflict coach, and the founder of Untangled Resolutions. My guest today is family and divorce mediator Jennifer Safian. Please join us as we examine mediating in multiple languages and cultures and explore innovations that address the challenges of building a practice in mediation. I'm here with Jennifer Safian, who is a divorce and family mediator, and I'm excited to have a chance to talk with her about what brought her into mediation, what keeps her in mediation, and what it means for her to be able to provide the services that she provides to her clients. I, of course, am most interested in this show in the lives of mediators and what inspires one to come into mediation. So it's not a show about mediation itself, generally speaking. You know, we're not talking about tips and techniques and tactics and so forth. But I want to know about you and what makes you tick. So tell me a little bit about your background.
Well, first of all, I want to thank you for having me on the show, Batabile. It's really a very, I'm very honored to be here, and so I thank you.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
So I grew up in Paris, France. I was lucky to speak three languages since I was very young, French, Spanish, and English. And because of my upbringing and extensive traveling that we did, I was always exposed to people from different cultures and different backgrounds. And as a child, it was kind of difficult to be from nowhere. People would say, well, where are you from? And I would say, well, I'm a little bit of this. I'm an American citizen, but I grew up in France. My parents speak Spanish at home. And in fact, I was born in Morocco, and so I kind of became like someone without any identity. But as I grew up, I realized the huge advantages that this brought to me. And I bring this into my work. In fact, as a mediator, working with people who are in conflict, whether they're from the same culture or different cultures, you are working with people who are coming from different places, emotional places, intellectual places, thinking places, who are at different stages in their emotional track. When people go through divorce, maybe one wants the divorce, the other isn't quite ready, or it's rare that both people are exactly at the same emotional place at the same time. So I find there's a big connection between working with people of different cultures and different backgrounds as working with people who are going through crisis, divorce, or other family conflicts, and who are in different places and think of their crisis as very different from the other person's crisis and don't understand where the other person is coming from. And so they kind of get stuck in this conflict.
I'm very curious about this. There has been some discussion in the field about mediators and cultural sensitivity and how much and whether at all, you know, it matters. In your own work, have you noticed a difference in how conflict is played out? Is there a difference when a couple comes from different cultures versus when a couple is from the same culture?
I find that there is not so much how the conflict's played out, but I work with a lot of people who are expats, who come from South America, from Spain, from France. Because I speak the languages, these people are sent to me to do mediation, and they want to mediate in their own language. When they're going through an emotional crisis, they really like to speak their own language. And the concepts are the same, the emotions are the same, but the way they envision things are different, and sometimes these couples where there's one person who's a North American and the other person who's French have already had some of these differences and conflicts in their marriage, and the same conflicts are coming into the divorce. So it's very helpful for me to be aware of these different cultures so that I can understand and I can reflect appropriately what each person is saying to help the other party understand where that person is coming from.
So having some knowledge of and some experience of the cultures that you also now work with does seem to help with the couples. Do you get a particular kind of response from folks when they realize that you're able to do that?
Yes. I mean, first of all, people search me for this reason, and they refer to me for this. But when they don't know and they find out that I do have an understanding, they feel comforted. I think they, you know, people who come to mediation, I think they have to have a trust in their mediator because they're expressing so much of their emotions. And this definitely creates a bond with the parties because they feel that I can really get it in their own way, in their understanding. Sometimes we'll use expressions of, in their language, or we'll, you know, even South Americans that live in New York, they kind of speak this mixture of Spanish and English, which is kind of not really a language, but I understand them. And so they like being able to use this kind of mixed language and feel understood.
Sure, certainly.
And that's really helpful, and I like to be able to provide that to my clients.
Mm-hmm. That's a marvelous thing. You know, it's not one of the things that I had envisioned coming into this conversation, but as you're talking about it, but of course. And I think often living here in the United States, you know, having grown up here, speaking American English, I haven't really thought about what it might be like to go through a horribly traumatic experience and have to do it in an unfamiliar or, you know, a second or third language, and how much
It really does mean a lot. And when I work with South American families, which happens quite a bit, especially the work that I've done in family court, mm-hmm. Hispanic families are often, you know, it takes a village to raise a child. So very often there are grandparents that come into the room, there are cousins that are there, or someone as a support system for the wife or the husband. And when the grandmothers only speak Spanish, the kids speak usually Spanish and English. So fortunately I speak both and I can relate to both. I'm a little bit older, so I kind of connect maybe with the grandmothers because of the age. But then I can speak to the children too, because I speak English, Mexican, who lives here, and they are more connected to the culture here since they've grown up here. And understanding how these families all are participating in the family conflict is very important. You don't see that in New York. Not so much. You see, you know, there's a father and the mother and the kids. How many times do the grandparents come in to the mediation? It's rare, unless they come in to complain that they don't see the kids enough or they have some problem. But otherwise, it's very different than the South American family.
So someone without this understanding and background might feel uncomfortable with having all of these family members there, or might want to insist on having a certain kind of, you know, what they're used to in terms of decorum, right? And so they want...
Well, you know, there's some mediators who are willing to accept other people in the room as long as both parties are happy with that and comfortable with that. Some mediators are much more rigid and will not do that. I tend to be more open, and I feel that if the... I don't want 10 people in the room and it's only two of them that are in conflict, but if one person says, you know, I really want to have my friend here, my cousin here, because for support, if the spouse is okay with that, I'll say sure. I'll ask them to kind of sit back and not interfere in the conversation all the time. But if it's an emotional support for the parties, why not? It's their crisis. It's not mine.
What a deep insight. And it's something that I work with my students on, is understanding what one owns as a mediator and what one doesn't own.
That's
as a
right.
mediator, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
And I tell people, this is your life. I'm not going to tell you what to do. I'm just going to be here to help you have this conversation. But this is your life. You're going to be making decisions, and you're going to have to live with this. When you leave me, I can't go and live with you. So it's important that you do something that you feel comfortable with.
Right. Right. So what do you do about people interjecting?
You mean outsiders who are not parties to the mediation?
Well, right. So, I mean, there is the question of who is a party,
mm-hmm.
okay? When you have a grandparent or, you know, cousins or other people who are there as support in the room, technically speaking, they're not parties, right?
Right, they're not.
And so what do you do in terms of establishing what is okay so far as they're participating or not participating?
Yeah, well, first of all, I want to say this is not all the time.
Oh, right.
It sounds like maybe I do this all the time. Not all the time. But
sure.
At the beginning of the mediation, I don't set rules because I don't like to make rules per se, but I kind of explain that the parties to the mediation are, and I give the names, and then I tell them that they're welcome and I'm happy to see them there, and that I will ask them not to interrupt, that if at any point either of the parties want to speak to them, they can step out of the room and they can have a conversation with them and then they can come back in. But I try and actually ask them to leave the parties, be the center of the conversation. And people are very respectful of that. There have been situations where there are multi-parties. You know, I remember a case where there were two grandmothers who were sharing the custody of a child. The grandmothers were in their 40s. The children were like 15 and 16, and they had this baby, and they were in school, and the grandmothers were going to raise the child while the kids were going back to school. So now there's one grandmother who speaks only English and one grandmother who speaks only Spanish, and they were having a very hard time communicating, and they were asking the kids to be their messengers, and the kids got really fed up, and they said, we're not going to be your messengers anymore.
So the kids were getting along, the parents of the baby.
Yes.
We're getting along.
Yes, they're going about school,
sure,
and letting the grandmothers take care of the baby. But the grandmothers are now pulling the baby because each of them wants more time with the child. And so they were kind of tense about that. And they couldn't speak to each other because they didn't speak the same language. So I had in the room the two grandmothers and the parents of the baby. The baby was actually in a carriage in the room, but too young to participate in the conversation. And the kids said, we don't want to be the messengers anymore of our mothers who keep fighting and send us with these angry messages to each other. So, in fact, what happened is they came for custody and to discuss sharing the custody among all of them and how much the one grandmother was going to have the child and the other grandmother, even though the kids were not giving up their custody and their rights as parents, but they were, in fact, allowing the grandmothers to really take over their role temporarily. So, but what became the main point of the mediation was finding a way for these grandmothers to communicate without using their children as messengers. That really became the crux of the mediation. And sure enough, they came up with a solution. They came up with a solution after I asked them and questioned them and they didn't know what to do and they were kind of upset. Well, finally, one of the grandmothers said, you know, my sister speaks both languages and she really loves this baby. And I think she would be fair and she would be able to help us communicate. I said, well, your sister's not here, so I don't think it's fair to give her this role of messenger without asking her. So she picks up her phone and she calls her sister and puts her on loudspeaker and got the sister on board. There was such a relief in the room. They were delighted. And after that, the scheduling went as easy as pie. It was amazing.
One of my favorite things about hearing these stories is hearing how it is that the parties ultimately create their own solutions.
Oh, we do.
Right?
I'm going to live with it, and it sticks much better when the parties come up with a solution.
Precisely. Ah, amazing. Amazing to hear. So
I have quite a few examples like that.
Yeah.
Where the parties came up with something that seemed so remote and so complicated to them until they actually were able to discuss and then they came up with an answer.
Yeah, that's beautiful.
Quite beautiful, yeah.
Well, and that's one of those things that is a delicious thing, I think I call it, about mediating.
Yes.
You know, we live for those moments, right?
Right.
So in realizing that moment and coming to epiphany about those potentials and then also just the joy of being a mediator, I'm curious about when that happened for you. When did you know that I'm meant to do this?
The first day of my first workshop in mediation was in the year 2000. I had a previous career and I decided that I wanted a new challenge in my life, and I signed up for this course. The first day I came home and I realized that this was what I was meant to do.
Oh, beautiful.
It was just amazing. And from then on, I just embraced it and was looking forward to every class, every book that I was reading. I was devouring this with such incredible appetite, which is the word. And I love doing mediation, even when they're tough.
Yes.
Sometimes it doesn't always work out. You know, every mediation does not work out. But even if they don't come up with a full plan, I do believe that having parties in one room and having a conversation brings something that wasn't there before. I really think so. Even if they leave without a solution, they may come down out with a solution later down the road. And actually, I've had people who walk out of my office angry that they came in, furious when they had come in, like saying, we're good friends and we're going to work this out. They leave furious. And a few days later, they called and they said, you know, we actually talked after that and we came up with a solution. And that is just as rewarding.
Oh, certainly. I'm thinking,
even though it didn't happen in my office.
Right.
It's terrific.
Right. Well, there's some kind of a seed that got planted.
That's right.
Right? In that moment, there's a seed planted. And it also speaks to the multiple purposes of a mediator. So there is that purpose of guiding people to a solution about the substantive issues, the distributive issues, mm-hmm. right? But then there is also that opportunity to expose folks to a different way of communicating with each other. And perhaps if that's what they go away with, even if they're not able to reach some kind of agreement in your office, at least they've received a little bit of a framework.
Yes, and what I find often is that they're too afraid to bring up a discussion between them. And so when they come here and I start asking questions and uncovering issues that have not been worked out, of course I'm the bad guy. And I tell them, I'm sorry, I have to be the bad guy because I don't want you to walk out of here, have an agreement, and down the road realize that it hasn't been worked out and then you're going to be really upset. So I help them uncover these issues which create tension and disagreements. And eventually they come on the other side, they come out on the other side and they have to work them out. But it's a process, and I kind of forgot where I was going with it, but it's a process which is like a discovery process that I have to help them turn up those stones that they were scared to turn up and look what's underneath and figure out what you're going to do with it.
Well,
and very often they have not discussed it and they don't want to discuss it without being in the mediation room because they're too afraid.
Right. So there are, you know, all these scary things, the unknowns. And, of course, you know, we understand through training that one of the roles of a mediator is to dash right in those things that nobody wants to talk about. You know,
right.
If I'm feeling kind of tense about talking about something, then I know that's the thing to talk about.
Exactly.
Right? When you are mediating, let's say it is a divorce,
mm-hmm.
The couple has decided that, this is the decision that's best for them. Actually, let me back up just a moment. In your practice, what do you find happens with relationships? I think that there's some folks who have an idea that if you go to a mediator, it's about working things out and not necessarily about getting divorced. Do you have a sense of some kind of statistic of how many people come into the mediation talking about divorce and then change their minds?
Not too many.
Mm-hmm.
In some cases where both parties are not fully on board at the same time and one person is kind of the one who took the lead on wanting a divorce and the other one is kind of going along with it because they realize they have no choice. If both people don't want to work on the marriage, it's not going to happen. If one person can't work alone on the marriage, so whether they're both on board or one is on board, I have very little hope that they're going to go back. There have been a couple of occasions where people will come in and they have some things going on, not sure, neither of them is really sure, and I have worked with them to help them resolve some practical issues, but then have, at their request, suggested that they see a marriage counselor. So they work some of the more practical things with me, maybe some financial issues that they have, that they don't really know how to balance their budgets, or one person spends more and the other one is making the money and there's a conflict on that. So I can work with them on those practical things. But when it comes to more emotional things, I'd rather refer them to a mental health professional. I don't have statistics on how many actually get over the hump and are able to work things out successfully. But sometimes they try, and at least I tell them, you know, at least you will tell yourself that at the end of the day, you've tried everything you can. You're really sure that you wanted to. You wanted to make sure that you tried everything possible before you gave up.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's very important.
Right. Right. Give them an opportunity to be able to walk through the process and leave the process feeling as though they've done the best that they could.
And sometimes they need to go to a couple of therapists to break up, to kind of understand what happened and why they're at the place where they are.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't help them walk that road. And not everybody wants to walk that road, but sometimes it may be helpful for them. Because one says they're taken by surprise because the partner says they want out. And they say, well, I don't know what happened here. I'm always surprised when people say that, that suddenly they're taken by surprise. And they had no idea the other person wanted a divorce. But it may be very, very well possible. So I think it's important that they have an opportunity to have someone help them have this conversation and understand a little better.
Right. Well, we've touched upon it a little bit, but I did want to hear it from you directly. When it comes to working with your clients then, how do you know that you've done well? What is your measure of, I did good?
Well, there are different measures. First of all, when things happen, like with this family I told you about where they came up with a solution, I thought I was helpful in getting them to that place or helping them have these conversations so they could come up with a solution. For me, that was a successful mediation. If the parties come in and really all they want is to have a divorce agreement and get through the divorce, and I'm able to help them have this conversation and deal with the parenting plans and the child support and the division of property and the financial support and all of this and come to a resolution on everything, they're happy. My measure is if they're happy.
Mm-hmm.
They feel that they've gotten where they want to get.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes they may feel they didn't get where they wanted to get right away. But hopefully it will help them down the road realize that they did. And I do have couples that will come in and they'll come for two or three sessions. And they've worked out, for example, when one party's going to move out, even before they get divorced, because the tension is so bad in the house that they have to have one party move out, but they don't want to move out before they have things resolved, financial things and schedule with the children, and they want to make sure that they're not going to lose their rights, like people like to talk about their rights. So if I can help them get through that and one party moves out, there's a sense of relief for everybody, including for me. And sometimes then they'll take a break and they'll start living separately. They have their parenting schedule in place and they'll work with that and see how it goes. And then they may come back months later to say, okay, we'd like to tweak the parenting schedule this way or that way. We tried it out and then they continue and they finish off the process. All these different ways I think are successful. People take breaks, people come a few times, people come several times in a row until they finish. It's very difficult to measure. I think it's tailor-made to each family.
So it requires a great deal of flexibility on your part.
Yes. I think absolutely we have to be open-minded and not feel that the parties have to walk out with a signed piece of paper, otherwise it's a failure. It's not necessarily a failure. The parties have to leave with something that they feel happy with. It can be only one thing, maybe. moving out of a house where you've been living for 20 years with your spouse and your kids is a huge thing. And that can be a success on its own. Did I answer your question?
Oh, no, absolutely you did. It has actually prompted another question, which is whether you've had to find a way to become comfortable with that kind of flexibility. Was it ever a challenge for you?
Not at all.
Mm-hmm.
Not at all. I think that I've always felt, maybe when I was in my first week of training, I thought that people had to come up with an agreement right away. But very quickly I realized that that's not necessarily the meaning of the mediation process.
Mm-hmm.
That we have to be there for our clients, and it's not for us, it's for them. It's really important.
Right.
And I tell every new couple that comes in or every new family that this is your process. I'm going to go by you. I'm going to follow you where you go.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to help you go where you want to go. I'm not going to direct you. I'm not very directive.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they talk about transformative mediation and directive mediation. I'm more the transformative style, even though I'm not purely transformative, but I really believe that it's their process and their life.
Well, as you said, you're not going to be living with them.
I'm not.
After, so.
No.
Definitely, they're going to have to live with this. You know, one of the other things that I find myself challenged with as a mediator is an internal pressure to live up to a certain standard in my own life when it comes to dealing with conflict. And I sometimes catch myself thinking, so this person has annoyed me, because it happens.
Sure.
And I want to engage, but I don't know that I can because, you know, I'm a mediator. I have this, this professional image sort of maintain and so forth. Is this something that you grapple with at all?
Yes, I mean, when we're emotionally involved, we can't deal the same way with our own conflict that when we help other people and we're kind of sitting on the outside of the conflict. But I happen to be on the board of a co-op, and we once had a conflict with the president of the board, who started asking the board to help him make a decision and gave us all sorts of different options, and we were supposed to vote at the end, and he decided to make an executive decision. And the other people on the board were absolutely outraged and told him in the board meeting how they felt. The president stood up, yelled at everybody, and walked out.
My goodness.
And all of us were sitting there thinking, so now how do we handle this? It was our conflict with the president of the board that we felt that, you know, he started asking us to participate in the decision, then he goes and makes the decision without consulting us. So everybody's sitting there absolutely agonizing, very upset that he was so upset. And we were actually it's outside of the city, in an office with a lot of windows, and we could see him pacing the sidewalk and looking very upset and angry. So what did these people have in mind? They asked me, the mediator, to go out and talk to him. Now, of course, I'm part of the issue as well, because I'm also a little upset that the guy made this decision. So I was kind of torn between, am I the mediator now, or am I a party to the mediation? But I decided to change hats, and I don't know if it's ethical what I did, but I did go out, and I spent a little time with him, and I told him I spoke with him, and kind of explained to him why it wasn't really mediation, it was more trying to, I guess, be a shuttle mediator between him and the board. Explained to him why people were upset, and try and understand why he was so devastated. And I brought him back, and he, even though he had told us that he was leaving and was no longer president of the board, he did come back and he continued his duties. So it worked out. He was very appreciative. So that was kind of a situation where I was kind of a party and trying to be the mediator. It was difficult. It was difficult. And as I said, I wasn't sure I was being fully ethical, but we got to what we wanted.
But you've hit upon precisely what I was getting at. You know, the folks who were in the room, the members of the board, know what your profession is. And so I'm thinking that, you know, they turn to you, as you said, for the by the fact that, or from the fact, based on the fact that, they know that you are a mediator. So then I wonder, just generally speaking, you know, whether you get the sense that they expect you to have a certain kind of behavior at all times. Like, you know, are you allowed to get upset and sort of be intransigent? And
well, if they don't, you know, I feel I'm allowed to get upset. What I've found in my, in, for example, in the experience of this board, is that I come up with a lot of questions, which a lot of people don't think about.
Okay.
And I think it's my training and work as a mediator that has given me that ability to ask questions and look at things from different angles that some people may not even think about. And that's been extremely helpful. And of course, if I play that role with my kids, they may say, "Mom, you know, you're not the mediator here. We don't need to be mediated by you." But in, say, on a board, they're actually happy because sometimes I come up with questions that nobody thought about, and it kind of uncovers all the options before we make decisions.
Right.
And I find that my experience as a mediator, my training, has really helped me look at things from different angles. So I can probably apply it in my life, but it depends with, if the people are too close emotionally, they're not going to take it from me.
The family. That is
the
a funny thing. Yes.
May not appreciate
yes.
that I do that.
My family has its own tales regarding that too. And, you know, I do slip into the mediator role.
And they don't like
but,
it.
No, they hate it.
Sure. Sure.
You know, so, well, on the one hand, if she said, just make it, just have an opinion already.
You know, I have a daughter who's a therapist.
Yes.
And so sometimes I'll discuss something with her and she'll go, and I'll say, Stephanie, can you please tell me, And I get so frustrated.
We take our professions home.
Yes.
Yes. Well, speaking of professions and you know, I was wondering, based on something that you said a little bit earlier, but now it's coming back to mind, about the business of mediation. You know, you talk about you have a particular niche that has developed. People know that you are trilingual, at least, right?
That's it. Trilingual.
Trilingual. Okay, so they know that you're trilingual. They know that you are able to accommodate a very specific kind of set of needs, and in my understanding, you know, from having taken some business development courses, is that finding a niche is really important. But just in terms of the business of mediation, what is that like for you?
I'm not quite sure I understand your question.
Well, you know, there's the mediating itself, but then one needs clients,
right,
to mediate. And
so what, you mean, how do I go about finding clients?
Right, to a certain extent. I mean, what I'm really getting at is this. When I am teaching and I have, you know, people who are new to the field who are coming in, one of the subjects that comes up is, well, what do I do with this knowledge? You know, can I go out and hang out a shingle and open my doors and say, you know, come to me as a mediator? Do I need to work for a CBRC, or do I need to work for you know, a company that happens to have a mediation program with, you know, like the post office program and so forth. So they're wondering, what do I need to do in order to build my business? If
well,
I'm going to
very difficult question, very difficult answer.
Mm-hmm.
I had a hard time with that in the beginning, and what I decided to do was, after taking a multitude of trainings, so I really created my own curriculum, because there is no fully made curriculum. So I created my own curriculum, and I continue to take courses. But I decided to go and volunteer. And I volunteered in the community mediation center in Yonkers, which is called Foster. And after taking their training, in addition to all the trainings I had, I did many, many hours of volunteer mediation, first with a co-mediator with supervision, and then on my own with supervision, and then by myself. Now I've become a senior mediator, so they asked me to actually supervise with the mediators. But it's interesting you're asking this question, because I've joined an organization that was started by a former referee of the family courts. And this organization is a nonprofit organization called Family Kind. They are mostly, their role is to offer parenting classes, parent coordinators, and mediation to people who may not have the means to hire private mediators and to go to parenting classes, which are more costly in a private situation. They're developing a program, and I'm actually one of the two people developing this program for them. We are going to be giving advanced mediation training to mediators who have taken basic training, who maybe have done a practicum, worked maybe in a community center, and now they're not quite ready to hang their shingle, but they need to learn how it works to develop a practice. And so we are in the midst of putting together this curriculum, and it's going to be a combination of one-on-one mentoring, of having these apprentice mediators come into the mediation room with us on a one-on-one with the clients, if the clients are willing to have them in the room, and having also some advanced courses. I also think it's important for them to learn how to draft documents, because a lot of these basic mediation training, they give you some information, but it's not, they don't really teach you how to take notes during mediation sessions and how to draft very detailed documents. So we're putting together this curriculum, and I'm hoping that we will get this program going by January 2014, and which will give much more practical tools for people to be able to then start their own business. But this is something that's been missing in the field, and a lot of us have had to figure it out on our own. So I think it's important that this is done.
Well, of course, I'm terribly interested in that myself, being that I'm one of those who has been figuring it out, right? And so it is something that I find, really interesting and to be very important. It's why I ask questions about that. Aside from, or in addition to, actually, having that kind of background, knowing how to draft documents, knowing how to run a business in general, having the training, that as you've been talking about, then there is the issue, the dilemma of the market. Mm-hmm. And either developing the market or educating the market. What has your experience been as far as that is concerned? I mean, I imagine you have people who come, they mediate with you, and then they go and tell their friends.
How do I get my referrals?
How do you get your referrals? But more than that, so there's the practical question of how do you get your referrals, but then there's the question of the field itself. And one of the things that I want to be exploring is that dilemma that I think mediation has been wrestling with for quite some time, which is, how do we get people to choose us?
Well, it's a very valid question for all of us. There's a tremendous amount of education that needs to be done, still needs to be done. I mostly get referrals from mental health professionals. When I reach out to mental health professionals, I realize that they've heard of mediation, they've heard it's a good thing, but they don't really know what it's like. So what I'm trying to do is make presentations to groups of people to educate them on what a mediation is, because they no, it's good, but they're not quite sure. So I think that's one part of our job. And I didn't realize when I went into this profession that I was going to be doing this. I never thought I would be a teacher or an educator or that I would be doing social media. And this, for me, it was very challenging, but I've learned how to reach out to people through LinkedIn, Facebook. I'm not so sure like it so much, but I post my blog. I write blogs every 2 weeks on different subjects, and I post them to LinkedIn, to all the groups that I belong to Facebook. And somehow people contact me because they read something that I wrote, and or they contact me to connect on LinkedIn, and then I actually make a point to call them up or make an appointment on the phone or to even meet them in person and explain to them. And people are so impressed with the field. And this is happening all the time. We have a tremendous amount of work to do.
Yes. One of the things that has constantly puzzled me has been this, that people will leave mediation when they do mediate, they will leave mediation really impressed by the process, feeling very satisfied most of the time when they do this, right? Feeling very satisfied with the process, you know, wondering at how different it is from an adversarial process, and appreciating that they had this agency that was available to them and so forth and so on. And I wondered to myself, well, why isn't everybody doing this?
Because people are so misinformed. A lot of the calls that I get from prospective clients, usually one-party calls, they found me on the internet through my website, or they found me, or somebody referred me to them. And the first thing they'll say, well, my husband and I don't get along. My wife and I don't get along. We can't talk without fighting, so we're not good candidates for mediation.
Ah, yes.
And so I say to them, well, it's because you don't get along that I'm here to help you. It's because you don't get along that mediation is the good way for you, because I can help you develop this communication. And I reassure them, I say, you know, you don't need to talk to your spouse. You're both going to come to mediation, sit with me, you talk to me. You're each going to talk to me and tell me what your needs are, what your wants are, and I'll help you explore, you know, what all the different options in order to resolve what you want, what he wants. But I will help you with that. So people have this misinformation that to come to mediation, they have to get along already.
Right.
Or that they have to have resolved all their issues before they come. Well, we can't come to mediation because we haven't worked on our problems yet. I said, well, that's why you come to mediation. I'm going to help you with that. Don't worry. You don't have to do it before. If you want to do some homework in between the sessions, by all means, I'll give you some homework to do. But nobody's asking you that, you know, to have this illumination of knowing what to do before the process. This is why mediation is here, to help you exactly that. So people are misinformed, and we need to do so much education.
I think part of being able to address that is to understand where that impression comes from.
I don't know. I guess mediation sounds like you get along already.
The point of mediation is to make you get along.
That's what it is. But people think you have to be able to get along to come to mediation.
Right. Well, actually, you know, what I'm getting at, though, with this idea that mediation is about getting you to get along, it's a little deeper than that. I think that people think that it means that you have to start to like each other.
No.
Right. And they don't understand that you can leave mediation feeling very satisfied, having your issues resolved, and still not like each other.
Right. That's right. Certainly when they have children, they need to develop a ways to communicate, even if they don't like each other, and put their feelings for each other aside, because they're going to be raising these kids for a lifetime. And sometimes I need to explore with them, well, how are the two of you going to communicate? Because right now they're not talking it to each other. And when they start a thread of emails become overblown, and they become angry, and they become bitter. And so we talk about sometimes, how are you going to communicate? How often are you going to communicate unless there's an emergency? Are you going to use text messaging, email, phone calls? And they kind of work through all those different ways, and then they come to a solution. It doesn't mean it's perfect, it's going to work out, but we have to narrow down the options for them, or help them narrow down the options.
How does having children involved change the process for you? I imagine that you work with couples who don't have children and then couples who do. Do you notice a difference in the way that the process works when children are involved?
I think it's extremely different because when they don't have children, once they get the divorce, they can never talk to each other the rest of their lives. It's not important. When they have children, they have to continue this dialogue and this communication. They're going to be raising their children together, not living in the same house, but together. So it's definitely extremely different, and I think the mediation process can also be a way to get them to start re-communicating because the communication is broken down when they get to the point where they want a divorce, and they have to start to learn how to talk to each other, not about each other, but about the children. And that's something we talk about a lot.
Not about each other, but about the children. That's such a key thing.
That's right. And when they're, you know, sometimes in the mediation room, we start talking about the parenting schedule, and suddenly one says to the other, yes, but I don't want you to see her because you did this to me, and you did that to me, and you did this to me. And I'll let them vent for a couple of minutes, and then I'll say, okay, I understand the two of you have a lot of issues between each other, and that's why you're at this point where you want to separate. But let's not prevent your children from having access to both of you. Let's not deprive them of both your love and your time because you have your issues with each other. So today you're here and to work on an agreement around your children, and let's just keep in mind that it's about them and about the fact that they both need you. And sometimes I'll ask them if they have a picture of their child, and I'll put it on the table and I'll say, you know what, when you start getting upset with each other, look at this picture of your child and remember that you're here for your child. And this will keep you connected to your child and working for the best interest of your child. It's very powerful.
I imagine. Yeah. Absolutely.
Doesn't always last the whole session, but you have to keep bringing them back to it.
Right.
No.
Right.
So that and they can focus on the child like that.
Right. Is there a point when, you know, perhaps if the children are a little older, that they are actively involved in perhaps the parenting plan process? Or, you know, involved in making decisions about what's going to happen in their own lives?
I've rarely had children come into the mediation. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't have them if they were young. You know, if they're 17, 18 years old, the parents often say, you know, we can decide whatever we want, but the kids, if they don't want to come to us and they want to go see their friends, we're not going to prevent them from seeing their friends. There was, I remember one specific case where the child was, the mother had sole custody of the child, and it was a boy, and the son told his dad, who was 17 now, that he wanted to go live with him because they shared a lot of love of sports, and he felt that his time with his dad was very limited. He was going to go off to college. And so the father called the mother and said he wanted custody of the son, and the mother got extremely upset and extremely hurt. They went to family court. I was called in to do a mediation. And in fact, what they both wanted is for me to talk to their son, to hear from him without them being present, what he wanted. And it was extremely helpful. This young man came, was very candid about what he wanted. He said, I really love my mother, but I have very little time left before I go away to college, and I want to spend a lot of time with my dad, and we watch television, on sports on television, we go to games together, we even hit a ball together, and I don't want my mother to be upset because she thinks that I'm rejecting her and I really feel bad, and he was feeling really upset, and I will still be with her for holidays and birthdays, but he was afraid to talk, afraid to break down, and he said every time he talked with his mother, she interrupted and yelled, so we came up with a solution. He was going to write a letter to his mom to explain. But I asked him if he felt that he could write something, and he said yes, because then he wouldn't be interrupted. So he wrote this letter, and then he decided he was going to read it to her in the mediation room with me there and his dad there. And he was going to tell her that the reason why he was doing this because he had prepared it, he didn't want to lose his temper or get upset, and he was asking her to just listen to him. It was incredible. He read the letter. He expressed all of what he wanted. And it was so emotional. She understood better that it wasn't the father taking away the child, that it was just the child really wanted time with his dad, and that he still loved her, and he expressed all this, and it was hard for the mom that the child was going to be living home with the dad, but she came away feeling that it wasn't a rejection of her. It was mostly about the sports issue and the time with dad. So that's a very powerful example of when I had a teenager in the room.
But I can understand them not necessarily involving the kids. Do the parents want to involve
not
the kids?
Not really,
ever?
No. Yeah. They don't. They don't because, and I think they're right, mm-hmm. because the children feel torn and they feel that if they say something about dad, mom's going to be upset, or dad's going to be upset, or vice versa, and I don't think it's such a good mm-hmm. idea, and most parents would rather not have them in the room.
Do you have a favorite kind of mediation, or favorite kind of case where, you know, they walk into the room and you just know that this one's going to be awesome?
No, very often it's the cases where I think it's not going to be awesome that turned out to be awesome.
Yeah.
It's very strange. I can never predict in advance which one is going to be awesome and which one isn't,
mm-hmm.
because there's surprises all the time. I have to go with the flow. People come in, I don't know anything about them, and I just have to go with the flow, and it's an amazing path. It's an amazing road, discovery.
But it's an adventure.
It's an adventure.
It's an adventure. I guess there has to be something in the mediator's personality that allows them to be sort of intrepid and to be okay with the unknown.
I am perfectly okay with the unknown, and I'm very calm in mediation. I'm very patient,
mm-hmm.
and actually people tell me that they feel that when they come into my office, it's kind of serene.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't prevent some of them from yelling a lot. And then they get a little, you know, they feel a little guilty, but I tell them it's okay, this is normal, and it's fine, and not to worry about it. But it is an adventure, and it's helping people go through this terrible, difficult transition.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I feel very honored that I can be part of that life for that short moment and help them get through this. It's, for me, it's very rewarding.
What do you hear after? You know, is there a time where 6 months later, a year later, perhaps after the dust has settled and folks are settling into their new lives, that you hear back from them?
Rarely I do.
Mm-hmm.
They have been occasionally people who have sent me a note telling months after, saying that, you know, they thank me and that now they finally found some calm and they're able to raise their children or have a communication. It has happened.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I don't expect it. People are busy with their lives. I'm just a stepping stone for them to go into their next life. And that's how it is. I mean, how many people call a doctor after they've been treated to say, thank you very much,
true
I'm
enough.
Feeling much better?
True enough.
You call the doctor when you're feeling lousy. And then when you're feeling better, I mean, I've learned, and I think it's only normal to let a doctor know that you appreciate what they did and you're feeling better.
Mm-hmm.
And occasionally I've written a note,
mm-hmm.
and the doctor got all surprised. Like, this rarely happens. So I don't expect it from people. When I get a note, it's really nice.
Oh, sure. I'm sure. But then it sounds like the main source of your gratification, if I can call it that, from the work that you do. But, I mean, it's important, I think, for us to be gratified by our work, for, you know, one to feel satisfied in what one does. Otherwise, you know, it's a life of drudgery, and who wants
it's
that?
It's when they leave my office and they say thank you.
Yes.
Thank you for being patient. Thank you for listening.
Mm-hmm.
That's the gratification.
Yes.
And sometimes when they are not able to resolve it, and a few cases do go up, you know, go to court because it's really impossible for them, I feel a little bad that I wasn't able to get them through the process, but I realized that there's something there that just isn't going to work.
It isn't for everyone.
And I cannot, exactly, yeah. It's not for everyone.
Right. Right.
And I cannot expect to be perfect.
Right.
I'm not perfect. And I can't resolve or help people resolve everything.
Mm-hmm. We're coming down to our last few moments together. This has been such a joyful and wonderful conversation to have with you.
And me too.
Thank you. I wondered if there was any, you know, last thought that you'd want to share, anything that I didn't hit upon.
Well, I guess
you
heard my passion about my work.
Yes.
I think this may have come through. If it didn't, well, I love what I do.
Yes.
I don't know how much time we have. I wanted to tell you a little story about a case that I had a few years back when I had a young couple come in. They were both deaf and mute. And they came with a language, sign language interpreter, because I don't speak sign language. I don't do sign language. And I was extremely anxious and extremely worried about this case because, you know, I'm very lucky I speak three languages and I feel comfortable, but suddenly I'm in a language I don't speak. And it turned out that this young couple knew each other since they were very young kids, and she got pregnant when they were about 15 or 16, and they got married, and then her mom took the child because the mom said that since they were both deaf and mute and disabled, they couldn't raise a child. The child had good hearing. And so they would go visit the child at the mom and take the child out and then bring the child back. And at some point, the marriage dissolved. The wife found out that she had other needs, and she met someone in another state. She was going to move away, and they came to mediation because the father was devastated not only to lose his wife, but now he felt that he was going to be even more remote from the child because the child was going to be with his mother-in-law. So he was asking for parenting time with the child at his home. And it was a very tense discussion. The mother said that she didn't feel comfortable, that he was not used to taking care of this baby, that she didn't think he could take care of this baby by himself, and that he could come and see the baby at her mother anytime he wanted. And he said no. He wanted to have the child in his home, that she was going to be living in another state, he was going to be there, and that at least if he was losing her, he didn't want to lose his child.
Right.
So this was another situation where they had to come up with a solution that would help him with the transitioning from never taking care of his child to being able to have the child overnight. And it was a very, very difficult case. But what came out in the end is that the mother's brother became very close friends with the husband, his brother-in-law. And so they all decided that the brother was going to take the child, he was single, on some weekends and go to the dad's, stay there with the child, and the two of them would take care of the baby and then bring the baby back to the grandmother on Sunday night. And they were all happy. The mother was happy because she felt that her brother was going to help, and her brother was living with her mother, so he actually had some practice with the baby. The father was happy because, in fact, even though he wanted to have this child, he was a little scared. This man was his friend, so they could do this together. And it was just, and then after this tension was resolved, they were sharing pictures of the child.
Oh, wow.
They were hugging each other. It was just beautiful.
Right.
It was just a beautiful story.
Yeah.
So I think that kind of also shows another beautiful ending in a mediation.
Sure. You were able to pinpoint that for the grandmother, it wasn't about the father having access to the child. She was just scared that something might happen to the baby and he wouldn't be able to hear what was going on or communicate if he needs to call for help. I know that there are resources available for that. I mean, if he's living by himself to begin with, then he is able to call, you know,
probably
in some way.
But she had no practice with the baby.
Right, right. So she wasn't assured, but then having...
This was, for me, one of my most special cases.
Yeah.
Most special cases, because this couple was just so touching and it was beautiful.
Right.
To see them smiling together, doing their sign language together, and exchanging pictures of the child, and talking about Oh, did you see when we started walking? And you see when we and they were just so happy together to share this.
Yeah. Oh, what a beautiful note to end on. Thank you so much for sharing that.
You're welcome.
And thank you for sharing this time with me.
Thank you for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Oh, yes. Anytime. We'll have to have you on again.
Thank you.